Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Hugh Warwick may be one of the biggest hedgehog lovers on the planet. He's performed stand-up comedy routines about them, had their image inked on his body, filled his office with memorabilia, written books about them. Yet, as an ecologist, he also knows that hedgehogs, for all their cuteness, can be a menace. They steal bird eggs and imperil other species. And when all else fails, sometimes you have to kill a species you love in order to protect another. Warwick ponders the moral complexities of conservation in his new book, Cull of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. And he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Hugh.
Hi, thank you, Anna.
You raise complicated and compelling questions in your book. You really made me think about all the animal species out there and how we approach which ones get to live and which don't, and why. And one of the central questions that you raise is the idea of human exceptionalism, that we as a species seem to think we should play God with the rest of the animal kingdom. So I'll start with a hard question first. Do humans have the right to kill one animal to protect another?
Well, I find that really interesting. I love the fact that you're going to start with the hard question. I don't think there are any easy questions or answers in this book. Now, I was interested. I used the word right. Do we have a right to do this? And then earlier this year, I was lucky enough to be doing a BBC radio program with Robin Wall Kimmerer, the author of Braiding Sweetgrass. And I was rereading Braiding Sweetgrass and found that she referred to responsibilities. And I had this sudden urge to get back to my book and rewrite a bit of it to include this as the framing of the question. Do we have a responsibility to step in and try and clear up the mess that we have made? One of those, I mean, you mentioned the playing God, and should we let nature take its course is often what's thrown at me. And one of the points I like to remind people is that we've already made the changes. We've already acted. We've already played God. It's just a case of whether we want to dump the clear up on Mother Nature's shoulders or whether we want to act responsibly and step in there and try and clear up the mess. Then it's a case of what do you do and what lengths do you go to, and are the ways you can do it ethically, consistently, sensitively, robustly?
Yeah, because I mean, when we talk about invasive species in particular, we have brought animals, flora and fauna, actually, to places they never were, and often places where they have no natural predators.
Well, I deliberately didn't touch on plants, otherwise my 300-page book would have been 1,000 pages. And I'm a mammalogist. I mean, my work has been, as you mentioned at the beginning, studying hedgehogs. Yes, I mean, there are these species which have been moved around the world. I mean, I'm amazed at the vast amount of it which has gone on. I mean, North America never used to have the common earthworm, our common earthworm. Now it has we're never going to be able to return things to some sort of prelapsarian idyll. And I think this is right at the heart of it, is what are we trying to achieve? We can't go back to any time when it was good, because we've been changing things all the time and things are going to keep on changing. So the questions which need to be asked, yes, responsibilities and rights, yes, absolutely. But fundamentally is, what are we trying to do by acting in the first place?
So let's talk a little bit about your favorite animal, the hedgehog. So as much as you love them, you've also written about the importance of culling, essentially killing them. And this was not a decision you seem to have arrived at easily. You take us to Scotland and what was playing out there with the hedgehogs decades ago. Can you kind of talk about what was happening in Scotland and what kind of damage they were doing to the bird population?
Well, yes, the very first work I did studying hedgehogs was back in 1986 up on a small island north of, the most northerly of the Orkney archipelago. And I was looking at the impact that hedgehogs were having there on ground nesting birds. There had been no hedgehogs on this very small island, 5 miles long, a mile wide, no trees, no cliffs, all flat. And the postman introduced hedgehogs in 1974 because he thought they'd be good at controlling garden pests. And it was a fascinating insight into the complex world of ecology, how the different things interplay. I returned, I repeated the work, I looked at the way that the birds were also being affected by changes in farming practices, the climate change, even back then, warming the water, meaning there was less fish close to shore. There were a whole bunch of effects. Anyway, skipping forward to 2003, and the news in the UK was filled with stories about a plan to kill hedgehogs in the Outer Hebrides. These are the islands to the west of Scotland. Again, same thing. Hedgehogs introduced because somebody wanted them on the islands. They weren't there before, and they were apparently munching their way through the birds' eggs. I initially went up there to record a program for BBC Radio because it sounded like a fascinating story. But when I got there, I discovered that the argument for killing the hedgehogs was based in part on some of the work I had done, some radio tracking studies. They said, if we move the hedgehogs alive, they will suffer a slow and lingering death. And they used my work, which had five of my 12 hedgehogs die, but none of them suffered a slow and lingering death. They were all fast and violent. Three were eaten by badgers, and two were run over by cars. Anyway, I joined the campaign, helped get the cull stopped, and I thought that was the end of it. Until I went to a hedgehog conference, an academic, there are these things. I know it's
I
quite
love
niche.
it.
Okay. The European Hedgehog Research Group. In fact, there is another one in Berlin in January I'm going to. And I met an ecologist, a conservationist from New Zealand. And he started telling me exactly the same story. Now, New Zealand, this amazing, gorgeous place. If you've not been there, you've probably watched the Lord of the Rings
Yeah, I was
movies.
going to say that's where it was filmed.
It's absolutely, it's gorgeous. And hedgehogs, they weren't on the islands beforehand. But in 1860, people from England got to, colonists arrived, and they looked around the place. This place is gorgeous. I can imagine elves and hobbits. But you know what it's missing?
Hedgehogs.
Missing. So they wrote back to England and they said, please send hedgehogs. And so they did. There was loads of stuff sent out there. The acclimatization societies caused havoc. For a long time, the hedgehogs were thought to be pretty benign, but now they've been shown to be causing a really serious impact. And for me, as a scientist above and beyond a hedgehog lover, I had to look at the facts. And this is the thing, if you are doing science and the facts change, you have to change your mind. So I cannot see any way that they can remove the hedgehogs from New Zealand without killing them. And so this is right at the heart and the start of my book, Cull of the Wild, was this collision in myself between my head, which was confronted by evidence which said, yes, we must kill them, and my heart, which was screaming in opposition, saying no. And yeah, that is the essence of the book, is that head-heart collision.
Yeah, we've had a similar conversation in Ohio over our deer population. Now, the deer are native to Ohio, but we've eliminated their natural predators. We've changed around their habitat, and now we're in this overpopulation problem. And it gets complicated because, I mean, wolves are a whole other controversial issue about whether you call them, whether you keep them, but they would hunt the deer. And now that they're gone, nothing really hunts them except for humans.
And this is one of the big problems. I mean, we have it exactly the same here in the United Kingdom. We have a big problem with deer. Deer are a problem in many places. About half of our deer species are imports, as it were. But even so, even the residents, as it were, the natives, can have a massive impact. And a lot of conservationists are very excited by the concept of rewilding. You're in the United States. You still have wild places. That's great. We don't really have wild places. So the idea of rewilding is important, but you can't have rewilding whilst you've still got the deer who are mowing down any saplings, any baby trees before they get a chance to pop their head above the parapet. And yes, we have no wolves either. We killed them all off. So what do we do? I haven't eaten meat for nearly 40 years now. In fact, I should begin. The first draft of the book began with the word prejudice. And I feel actually it would have been more honest to go in with this for the interview, because I wanted to lay out my prejudices, because I recognize, having spent a long time looking at these subjects, I come with baggage. And so I've not eaten meat for nearly 40 years. For 10 years, I was a strict vegan. Now I describe myself as a vegan, which is vaguely vegan. So I sort of oat milk on my muesli, soy milk in my tea, but I do a lot of talks for the groups, the women's institutes in the United Kingdom, and they do really good cake. And so I can't Turn those down. And so what I'm, so that idea of coming and being honest about where you're coming from meant that when I talked to people who were killing for conservation, I could be very upfront and say, this is how I feel. So could you be honest with the fact that you must recognize you've come with your own prejudice? We're each in our bubbles, and you'll find that your bubble will tend to tell you that you are quite meek and mild in your feelings. And also to remember that the curve of the edge of a bubble acts as a lens which distorts the view of other bubbles. And so we end up having conversations which you think might be about the same thing, but actually aren't. So anyway, so going back to the deer, yes, I was going to people who fervently believed you should never kill anything, hardcore animal rights activists, and explaining how, but what do you do in these circumstances? It's not that by leaving the deer alive, you're taking death off the table. There is still going to be death there because there's a whole bunch of life which will never get to thrive because the deer are still there. So how do we act in these instances? And that is, yeah, right at the heart of this challenge in the book.
I have to say, one of the things I didn't expect to do while reading your book was laugh, but you have definitely managed to weave these amusing and self-deprecating anecdotes throughout the book, including your own personal biases. So I really appreciated that you were following George Bernard Shaw's advice. If you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh, otherwise they're going to kill you.
And obviously that was said with a slightly light heart, but when Bloomsbury, the publishers, first the editorial team said, we want this book, but they had to take that to a sort of a security safeguarding team as well, because they were concerned about what the reaction might be to the contents of the book. And actually the reaction from both sides of the debate, which is something, again, which the book sort of teases out, is that we end up with these polarizations when it comes to complicated subjects, which, one of the highest bits of praise I got, I was doing an interview with another American radio station, and the interviewer said that he particularly loved the book because he found it applicable to the political situation in the United States now. And I had a moment to think about it. And he's saying, no, because you are talking about implacably separated, polarized views who have been put there deliberately by social media platforms to engage outrage, to engage attention, which of course engages money. And that you're willing to stand in the middle and speak out. That's not where the normal people will tend to stand, because you get shouted at by both sides.
Yeah, and you're pretty straightforward about things that work and things that don't. You know, you write about how you had to keep track of the 20 hedgehogs translocated to a new environment for a month, how you wanted to see if they could adapt to a new environment or experience those slow deaths. You're honest about the challenges of trying to take, you know, hedgehogs from New Zealand on transoceanic voyages and whether that would work. So I often find that the truth is nuanced, and I sort of appreciate all the nuance in those conversations.
And I think the difficulty is that so often our conversations are reduced to 100 and 140, I can't remember how many it is now, but short social media soundbitey things. And actually having the time to work through ideas. And for me, in honesty, this book was a process of work for me. I didn't go into this book knowing how it was going to end.
I always love that. I find my best interviews are always when I don't know how it's going to go. One of the other things that I found fascinating was that the removal of the hedgehogs didn't correlate with bird population increases. What did that tell you? What did you take away from that?
That this is ecology and therefore it is complicated. What I mean, they did in some instances and it didn't in other instances correlate. So what it's pointed to was the fact that yes, hedgehogs are part of the problem, but they're only part of the problem, and there are many other factors at play. And that actually, whether it's the hedgehogs in the Outer Hebrides or whether it's a whole host of invasive species in New Zealand, there are other things you can do which may protect the native species, which don't involve killing. The killing of the invasive non-native species is the easiest choice to make in most circumstances, because it's a bit like your reaction to I know problems. I don't know How it is. I think I'd begin to get an idea of what it's like in the United States, but certainly in the United Kingdom, there is a certain view, political view, which will tend to look at the most recent incomer who looks most different and blame the woes of the world on them. And so you'll find that with species in places, it will often be them which become the scapegoat. When actually, for example, in New Zealand, one of the problems that New Zealand's got with this an amazing number of invasive species is that the landscape is so heavily degraded already, despite what the PR company for New Zealand said through Lord of the Rings. It's a massively degraded, extracted, industrialized, agricultured landscape, which means that the native species have already been pushed to the brink, and then releasing possums, rats, cats, hedgehogs, has caused these animals to then be pushed even closer to extinction.
You also note that hedgehog work is different than, say, the work to prevent the extinction of rats or minks because hedgehogs are cute. They look adorable, and that we as humans tend to prioritize the cuddly species over, say, the less adorable counterparts.
And you're absolutely right. It's something which I struggle with because essentially, a mink, an American mink, which was released over here because the fur industry was, they decided it was good to have them in the UK. These two animals are both beautiful, amazing, sentient beings. And a choice has to be made as to, and certainly up on the islands around, Scotland, where there are mink and hedgehogs, the mink, the rats are killed, nobody minds. Yet there is just as much potential for pain, suffering, joy, happiness in the lives of those animals. And we are making this executive decision that the lives of some are worth more than the lives of others. And there are some good reasons why this is the case, but it is a version of, I mean, Peter Singer, the philosopher, described the idea of speciesism, the idea that we do have preferential speciesisms, and we have, and we are the best. We are the human exceptionalism is right there at the top. We are exceptional. We are only exceptional, and I just did bunny ears there for your listeners, because we have been blessed slash cursed with consciousness. We've got the capacity to go, okay, so we've actually got this ability. We recognize it, we've got self-awareness. But when you start to strip that back, again, you can't work on this in a polarized way. All of the attributes which you go and associate, if you try and associate humans as exceptional, but actually Caledonian crows and chimpanzees and bonobos and gorillas and orangutans, probably dolphins, but it's very hard to talk to a dolphin, have got capacities which are similar, if not equal, to these things. So if we're going to be basing it just on capacity, then we need to begin to soften the edges of this and begin to accept maybe we need to start treating some of the non-human animal world with a little bit more respect.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up, we're going to explore speciesism and why the some so-called solutions sometimes make the problems worse. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour with British author Hugh Warwick. He writes about the moral complexities of conservation in his new book, Call of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. You write primarily about conservation efforts in the UK and New Zealand, but I wanted to see how you would compare those efforts with what we see here in the US. I think it's a universal story that we struggle with what to kill, when, and in what quantity?
I should first of all say the reason the book is centered around the United Kingdom is largely based around one of money. And I read a lovely book by Emma Maris, an American writer, who had done similar things and gone off to the Galapagos and Hawaii. And I was just so green with envy with these things. I'd love to have gone across. Over to the West Coast and had a look at the various different sorts of very, very interesting owls you've got who are misbehaving over there. So there are many, many stories. So, yes, that is the reason. It wasn't that I was being entirely parochial for parochiality's sake, just that there are limits to my budget. But it is a universal, and it's something which I'm quite fascinated by, is the idea that in the future, when... Yeah, in a million years' time, archaeologists come back and start to sort of work out what went on at various times in history. They're going to find this really weird moment when suddenly all the fossils seem to get mixed up. And that we've been recreating Pangaea, the original supercontinent, which sort of split apart to create the mass of continents we have now. And it's going to cause enormous amounts of confusion. They're not going to know how on earth this happened. But it is. And we... bless ourselves, have a capacity to arrive in places and cause trouble. Wherever we go, we start killing things. In fact, I suggested an idea that renaming our species rather than Homo sapiens, man and wise, that we be Homo ochisaur, which is man the killer, because basically wherever we go, we cause dramatic changes, whether that is through 10,000 or more years ago, the humans who moved across from Siberia down through the Beringia and across the Americas. Ahead of them was swept a swathe of mass extinctions of the charismatic megafauna as they would have been then. You've got enormous beavers the size of bears, that sort of thing. It would be amazing to see those things. But humans wiped them all out. And then on top of that, we bring species that weren't there in the first place, and things become even more chaotic.
You know, the concept that you talk about of speciesism compared to racism, like I had to put the book down, I had to stop, and I had to really think about that, because the othering of animal species is in a way correlated to the way we other people.
Yeah, and I think that word, othering, is really important, because that's what speciesism gives us the capacity to do. But it's more than that. It's more than just the species. It's down to the name we give an individual within that species. And the examples are amazing. A vet used to work for the government in the United Kingdom called Alex Simmons, and he wrote a book called Treated Like Animals. And in that, he gives the example of three rats, Rattus norvegicus, the brown rat. And we give them three different names and give them three different jobs, and we treat them entirely differently, despite the fact that each one of these rats has exactly the same capacity to experience pain, fear, joy, happiness. They will protect their young. They will look forward to trying to protect themselves into the future. And the examples he gave were that one of the rats is a pet rat, because they're really intelligent creatures. They make very good pets. And these animals get looked after. They're protected under some animal protection law, but they'll be given veterinary care. And if they get really, really ill, they'll be put down. And then he describes a rat which is kept in a laboratory for animal testing. And some of those animals are tested on, some of them aren't. But they should be kept very carefully, and they should be, and I use that word very advisedly, the welfare should be maintained, and there is a named human responsible for them, and there are potential prison sentences for abusing these things. And at the end of their lives, they should be killed humanely with a lethal injection. And then you've got the rat which breaks into your kitchen and starts to steal your dried lentils. And for that, you can put down poison and forget about it. And that rat will die a horrifyingly cruel death.
Yeah.
And yet they can all suffer exactly the same sensations. Yet because we have othered some of them, given them a different name, we can treat them in ways which we would never treat a pet. But yeah, it's the same.
Yeah, we did a segment not too long ago about a popo, and they're creating these rescue rats that'll go into collapsed buildings and wear little cameras and help find people who are trapped, right? Because they're tiny and they're smart and they have great senses of smell and they could go find people. But they also said they had to do a campaign so that if you're trapped in a building and a rat comes up, you don't lose your ever-loving mind. Because people can be afraid of rats. And scared about that this thing is here to eat my face, not save me.
I think what they should probably do is, as they did with the St. Bernard's dogs that went to rescue people lost in the snow.
Oh, the whiskey. Maybe
a small flask of whiskey around the rat's neck just to make sure you felt safe.
Yeah, popular culture does this so much. I mean, you think of snakes, biblically, they're evil, right? There are horror movies about spiders. It's why we want to save Bambi and kill the big bad wolf.
Yeah, but there are many more horror stories about people.
Oh, yeah.
And when you come down to it, snakes, spiders, yes, whatever. But actually, if you're going to be frightened, really, I would suggest people are slightly more of a worry, especially in countries with anti-venom and light, which you can use at night. Where if you're living out in the bush with no external light sources, then yes, I would be, and have been when I've been in Africa, absolutely terrified about the wildlife. I wouldn't recommend waiting by the side of a road at 3 o'clock in the morning for a lift when you know that there is a leopard prowling around. It's very unnerving.
You devote a whole chapter to islands that are working to be entirely rat-free. And in a couple of cases, they have succeeded. So Lundy has been rat-free since 2006. How did they accomplish that? Like, why did they want to get rid of all the rats?
And you're absolutely right to emphasize the word all. What became clear, and this was not something I knew before I got into this, is the really distinct difference between control and eradication. And that if you go into one of these complex stories with an aim of controlling the problem, you end up essentially harvesting whatever the problem is into the future. So all of the work that goes into Lundy is a very, very tiny dot in the Bristol Channel. You can see both Wales and Devon from the island when the weather is clear, which is about one day a year. And it's a gorgeous little spot, amazing bird life, which had been almost completely removed. The breeding success of the ground nesting birds, the puffins, the Manx shearwaters, had been wiped off by rats. And if they had gone in and controlled the rats, rats would still keep breeding, they would still be there. Also, what that means is you end up killing far more than you would have done if you eradicated. So they worked very hard and went to eradicate, remove the rats in as short a period of time as possible, so that actually, counterintuitively, far fewer rats end up being killed. And that example was tiny. The example of South Georgia in the South Atlantic was one I met with Tony Martin, Professor Anthony Martin, to be more formal. And what an amazing and remarkable character he is. He took on the idea of removing the rats from South Georgia, a very, very remote dot in the South Atlantic. And again, it was the whalers, it was the sealers who turned up their boats and boats shipwrecked on the islands and rats jumped off and rats made merry heaven with the great supply of ground nesting birds. No trees there at all. James Cook was particularly, this is back in the 18th century, particularly unimpressed with South Georgia because it was a wasteland. But the rats loved it because there's all this easy food. And it's sort of weird, but that we stopped killing the whales, we stopped killing the seals, the whales and the seals have returned. And humans basically left the island pretty well. But in doing so, we left behind the rats, and that has slowly eroded these bird populations. And again, what they did there, they had to eradicate. You leave five rats behind, have many million get killed. You leave five rats behind, they can start it all again. You have to be, if you're going to do it, you need to do it and fix the problem, not just do something to make yourself feel a bit better and then go away and hope it'll solve itself.
Yeah, you had this number that was stunning, that by 2000 on that island, there was just 13 puffins, down from 3,500 decades earlier. So,
This is Lundy. Yes, this is Lundy.
But sorry, going back to Lundy, they had eaten the puffins almost out of existence there.
Yeah, and it is, and those, I mean, puffins are
they also are adorable. They're really
cute. Remarkably charismatic bird, and people come to the island to see them, and it is it. But a choice was made that the puffins were more important than the rats, and this is going back to your earlier questions about speciesism. I understand why that choice was made. These are internationally important populations of these birds, but an active choice was made to say that they are more important than the rats. And I think one of the steps I'm hoping the book will do is just to remind people that these processes need, you need to acknowledge these active choices you're making. These aren't just things which are, they're there. They are decisions you make at each stage. The decision not to kill something is still an active decision. It's not just, you know, you have to take responsibility, whatever happens.
You also wrote about the cane toad in Australia. And this one actually reminded me of an old episode of The Simpsons where they have a rat problem. So they bring in snakes and then they have a snake problem. So they bring in mongooses and then they have a mongoose problem. And it just like escalates over the course of this episode.
Now you've told me this. I'm just like, I wish I'd known that. I'd have written about it. Excuse me. Just carry on with the question. I'm going to write some notes. Sorry.
Yeah. So the cane toad, it gets introduced in Australia in 1935 to control the native beetles. But now there's more than 200 million of them. And it definitely sounds like a lot of unintended consequences.
Oh, I mean, and this is the thing. Unintended consequences all the way. The unintended consequence with the cane toad. And it's, the animal is it's an amazing amphibian. And it just happens to be extremely poisonous and will eat anything that it can get into its mouth. And every step of its way from the tadpoles through to the adults, even the eggs, are all poisonous to many of the species which live in Australia. And so a great deal of effort is put into trying to kill them, but they're never going to eradicate the cane toads from Australia. I mean, people then sort of talked about introducing other species to try and control the cane toad, and you can just see where this goes. In fact, it is the Simpsons episode, and I'm going to be distracted for the rest of this interview. Think I can't wait to get onto YouTube and try and find it.
I just Googled it. It looks like the episode is called Bart the Mother.
But
and so, yeah, it's in the 10th season. And so, yeah, if you go find it, I just remember it as a big Simpsons fan. And it's like, well, what happens when we're overrun by the lizards? And they're like, no problem, we'll bring in this. And then what happens when there's this? And it's like, it ends up in this like massive street brawl between all the different species that they've brought in.
I can't, it's just typical of the Simpsons is to be so way ahead of everything. It's just, never mind the mathematics. It's just, oh, well, I feel humbled that I've been usurped by a cartoon as a figure of sort of ethical and philosophical discourse in this subject.
But yeah, the cane toads, man, they are poisonous. They are predatory, adaptive, competitive. I mean, they are just that example that they got in to solve a problem and then they created a whole new one.
Yeah, and there are many other examples. One of the ones I found fascinating is Chairman Mao discovering that sparrows eat enough grain to sort of feed millions of people. So therefore he sends out an edict that everybody should go and kill sparrows, and millions of sparrows get killed. And the next year, there's a complete famine, because what he didn't know was the unintended consequence was going to be removing these sparrows, which feed vast numbers of insects to their young bird, you know, the young sparrows, for the first few days of their lives, first few weeks of their lives. And these insects are the insects which are the pests which eat the grain. And so he ended up creating a famine. We do this. We end up thinking we are going to solve a problem and we end up creating more. Hence the reason why I'm very, very keen that any of these actions take place with ecologists right at their helm. In fact, I think that ecologists ought to be overseeing pretty much everything any government does anywhere, because of they are more likely to be systems thinkers and look at the implications further on. You know, whether it is to do with, you know, burning fossil fuels or using, you know, our dietary choices, any of these things. Let's get ecologists in tables of power rather than necessarily economists. But anyway, that's another story.
Yeah. Coming up, we're going to talk about alternative solutions to culling animals and the big question, where do we all go from here? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
the candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour with British author Hugh Warwick about the moral complexities of conservation and calling to save species. It's all chronicled in a new book, Call of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. Towards the end of the book, you write that, quote, everywhere I go, it seems that there is killing. I'm getting tired of the lack of imagination. I feel there must be a better way. So let's talk about some of those potential better ways. One method that you talk about is genetic engineering, a way to control the wildlife without killing. So how would this work?
I mean, yeah, in about 20 years' time, it might work. there are techniques, gene drive techniques, where you could insert a trait into a population which would maybe render it infertile or render it to only produce males or whatever. They're working on it right now with insects, particularly to do with health and agricultural pest issues. But obviously, and most of the issues we're dealing with vertebrates, with mammals in particular.
Oh, I've heard about this. It's in southern Florida. They're doing it with the mosquitoes that create, what is that one disease that
dengue?
You really... No, but they're doing it with mosquitoes to prevent. It's the one where if you're pregnant, the brain doesn't fully develop in the baby.
Okay, yeah.
I can't think of it now. But yeah, they're trying to breed sterile and then cause the species that carries this disease to die out.
Yeah. And I mean, that is part of a plan. But however, again, this is, you know, the work of people who are looking for silver bullets, looking for simple answers. And in fact, in the book, I on more than one occasion mention the problem of complex problems being gifted simple answers. The people who give you those simple answers are either going to be foolish or duplicitous, because on the whole, complex problems don't have simple answers. So there are a dearth of good alternatives. I mean, there are a few which are being discussed. There is potential with dingoes in Australia. I mean, the dingoes they have been for years persecuted by the colonists who arrived wanting to breed sheep and help desertify chunks of Australia. And so the dingoes have been killed cruelly, inhumanely for a very long time. Then we've got the arrival of, in particular, foxes and cats. And in fact, wherever you go with these things, there are lots of amazing wild animals which are causing trouble. But most conservationists will say the biggest problem actually comes from cats. And cats run a protection racket. They seduce you into thinking that they're nice and lovely, but actually are going out at night, ripping the heart out of your ecosystem. So that's my own biases coming to the fore. But what they found that in parts of Australia where you had stopped killing dingoes, the dingoes themselves were controlling the foxes and the cats to such an extent that the native wildlife, those marsupials which were being driven to extinction by foxes and cats, were able to survive. And that didn't involve people going out there with particularly unpleasant poison, killing the foxes and cats. So there is a sort of win-win. And there are examples of trying to control goats on small islands has been a particular problem, because for centuries, goats would be left on islands so that if there were shipwrecks, sailors would get there, they would have something to eat. You know, you'd leave goats be scattered around the place. And then they would themselves cause problems with the ecosystems there, eating the vegetation. They're difficult to get rid of. So they tried it with dingoes, they then released the dingoes, sterilized dingoes onto the island so that they then control the goats. And it becomes a way you're not going in there poisoning the goats. Yes, you are killing things. And I was quite excited by this story until the story ran full sweep and you discovered that the dingoes themselves had radio trackers on them so that they could be tracked after the goats were killed and then shot. And failing that, they also had an inbuilt little poison capsule, which was designed to explode after 2 years, filling their body with poison and killing them. So
oh my
it was
goodness.
A story which went from being quite exciting to being really quite sad quite quickly.
Oh my goodness, that feels so, I don't know if it's sci-fi, I don't know what the right dystopian, yeah. But they're embedded with a poison capsule that will explode at a certain date. That is like dystopian sci-fi.
Yeah, no, in fact, there is a film where people have got that, I think, isn't there? I'm sure will write in and say. So yes, there are, but the point I realized is that the effort is tending towards the killing as an option. And there isn't the effort, there isn't the money, there isn't the resource put into alternatives. And that's what I meant, is like there must be some capacity to be able to work these things out. And a lot of it is down to, well, the first one is don't be an idiot. But obviously we need to send that in a time capsule back a few hundred years to our ancestors. So don't be an idiot is the first one. But after that, it's okay, can we adapt? Can we manage our environment such that there is some sort of capacity for it to be able to hold both species? And that's something which requires an awful lot more work, but it is right at the heart of it. We have created such degraded landscapes that the native wildlife has already been pushed to the edge. And then when you introduce an extremely effective generalist predator, that's just the final straw, and off they go.
You also talk about compassionate conservation. I almost said compassionate conservatism, which is a whole movement here, particularly in the early 2000s in U.S. politics. But what does the phrase compassionate conservation mean?
It's actually quite a broad church, as it were. I interviewed Mark Beckoff, a philosopher and writer from the United States. He's in Boulder in Colorado. And he was amazing, fascinating, intelligent communicator, but with a very clear line, which is you don't kill. And so that's the sort of extreme end of compassionate conservation. But what I found interesting is the much more nuanced ways that people have worked their ways through it. And there's a brilliant she's a zoologist, and I think she's working with veterinary scientists now, called Sarah Dubois in British Columbia. And she gave a list of seven different sort of things. And basically the idea was, don't go killing anything unless you've ticked off all of these things. And it was just simple things. First of all, alter the human practices. Can you do something such that there isn't the problem in the first place? So as you develop a culture of coexistence. Is there enough evidence to prove that this is actually a really big problem? And then talking about measurable outcomes and making sure that this isn't just about control, but eradication, trying to do the minimum amount of harm possible. And then if you basically a list of seven different ideas, and it was just like, this is how it should be done, much more thoughtfully, rather than treating, what is that idea that you, if you're a hammer, you treat every problem
everything
as
a nail.
Yeah. And so it's that idea. We end up with that sort of situation. And so we treat everything with the same sort of reaction. And actually, you used the word nuance first. I've been accused of using that too much, but it is. It really is. It's subtle, and it requires subtle thought.
Yeah, I had a pullout of a quote you got from Sarah Dubois, and it was, the frustration I have is the lack of reverence to individual life. And I thought that was a good way of putting it, is that if we're going to go down the route of extinguishing the life of another creature, we should have tried other things first.
And I think it's important I have an innate aversion to the sort of easy, sort of semi-spirituality, sort of, ooh, nice new agey feel about things. I get it's like, no, I want data. But listening to Sarah Dubois, and I go back to Robin Wall Kimmerer as well, and that idea that maybe treating the world, treating the world around us with a little bit more respect might be really quite beneficial. And even that idea of reverence, that may not be a word which sits easily with many people. It doesn't necessarily with me. But then actually, I recognize, the reason I don't eat meat isn't that I don't love it. I say it's going to be 40 years very soon. And probably every day at some point, I'm going, oh, wouldn't that be nice? I haven't stopped. Yeah. So there is more to it. There is my prejudice is based on a whole bunch of things. And part of it is if we use the word reverence, a reverence to the lives of these animals. I don't need to kill them. There's absolutely no need for me to kill them directly or indirectly by paying somebody else to do it for me. So therefore, why do it? You know, you do it because what? You get a fraction of a second of a dopamine hit of pleasure. But that's killed in often extremely cruel circumstances, another animal. And the same is applied to the conservation message. Do we really need to do it? If we really need to do it, how do we do it in such a way that the minimum amount of suffering is caused?
Yeah, Mark Beckoff, who is from Boulder, who is also in the book and we just talked about earlier, had this great analogy when we talk about bias and how we think about animals that we kill versus animals that we don't. And I think you're nodding, so I think you know where I'm going. But he said he usually gets a gasp out of audiences when he says, suppose I show up at your door and tell you there are too many golden retrievers and we need to call the population.
Yeah, I have to say,
people
I think
lose their minds.
Yeah, well, also his example is mischosen because it is actually physically impossible to have too many golden retrievers. but no, I mean, obviously the point he's making is that, yes, you will immediately react against that. Yet that golden retriever has probably less capacity to experience the joys of life than a wolf does. But that wolf has been determined to be in excess in that particular place. And so, it is a point well met and it gets people to think. And it is that idea of speciesism. I would point that we have hierarchies. We have innate hierarchies of care. An example I give, if my child is standing next to a stranger in the street and there's a runaway car and I can only grab one of them, I'll grab my child. Not that I don't like, care for, revere the other person in any way. It's just that you have a hierarchy of care. Similarly, my dog over a stranger's dog. You will have these hierarchies. And that's why I think that Mark Beckoff's position of absolutism, I realized having talked to a bunch of philosophers, he has a deontological way of thinking, normative way of thinking. It doesn't work in these situations because these situations need the nuance that comes with a more utilitarian perspective, weighing things up. Is it you need to accept that there is a hierarchy of care? Also need to accept that by not intervening and not killing, you actually can end up with more death.
You also write about legislative framework that protects animals depending on their status and, sort of the legal example. Government can pass laws. We have laws about how animals can be treated for food consumption. Now, some might argue they're way too lax, but there are standards, and there are standards for how they're killed, how they're butchered, how they're kept. So, I mean, it's interesting to me that the Animal Welfare Act of 2006 protects animals against abuse, but farm animals are allowed to live in far worse conditions.
Absolutely. And the Alex Simmons, the vet I mentioned earlier, he would go around checking these things and the conditions in battery farms in places which are producing chicken. Oh, my goodness. The amount of suffering which goes on in those places is absolutely extraordinary. We have a very, very blinkered view of what these things are. We will be outraged if we saw somebody abusing a chicken in the street, breaking its neck in front of people, yet happily tuck into a bunch of chicken served to you in a bucket because you don't see it, you don't understand it, you don't know it. There was a lovely example a while ago. Somebody suggested that all abattoirs ought to have glass windows surrounding them so you can see what you are complicit in causing.
Yeah, my husband's family is like multi-generational hunters. And it is a quite a thing to go to watch, to see, to butcher. It gives you, in some ways, a real appreciation, as strange as that sounds, for where your food comes from.
And that's where the word reverence comes in. I don't know about your husband's family, but certainly friends of mine from Canada, from First Nations people up in Canada, they will go hunting. And yes, that's not something I do, but there is a real connection of reverence and a real consumption of every single part. Even the gamekeeper in England, who I went to go and spend time with, he said he likes nothing better than an armed nature ramble. He only shoots things which go into the pot. He eats them immediately. And he says success for him is that the bird is dead in flight. And that is, for me, a world away from the careless consumption of meat in a fast food joint.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of emphasis in hunting on good shots and bad shots, good kills and bad kills. you can have the hide professionally tanned and make stuff out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to kill it, use it.
So that was Hugh Warwick, the author of a new book about the moral complexities of conservation, Call of the Wild, Killing in the Name of Conservation. You can find it wherever books are sold. And I'm told we even have copies here at the Columbus Library. So thank you so much for your time today, Hugh.
An absolute pleasure. And just to say, the audiobook will be available in November.
Oh, that's right. I understand you've just been recording it.
Yeah, 2 days solid.
Oh my goodness. I'm glad you had a voice left for today.
Anyway, Anna, a real pleasure to meet you.
And thank you all so much for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.